All right. Thank you, Mike, and thanks for the invitation. I had a great time so far. I think that's a very nice setup that you have here, people talking to each other, and the diversity of talks is also very inspiring. So I put a very general title there that tells more about the work that we're trying to do in my lab than about the specific talk that I'm gonna be giving. This is the outline of my talk. Shetty asked a few days ago that we say what we think is ECB, evolutionary cell biology. So I'm gonna tell you what I think it is. I think we all have different views depending on where we come from on that. And then I will tell you about the study we did that a PhD student in my lab did, looking at the redundancy between gene duplicates and how we could try to explain that at a molecular level. And then, if I have time, and I think I will tell you about some work that we've started doing in experimental evolution. And I'll talk about compensatory evolution and why it depends, the course of compensatory evolution, how it can depend on where you start as an organism. So this is how I see the fields that I work in are organized. So I think in population genetics, we've seen very well, and Mike has illustrated that, that we worry a lot about mutations, especially Mike, I would say. And then we're interested in fitness and understand how we can get evolution from mutations and fitness. And if we don't know a lot about population genetics, we think only about fitness, but then there's obviously effective population size as well illustrated by Mike in his previous lectures. And when we work in cell biology or genetics in general, we're interested in this relationship here. Like mutation and phenotype, we're basically removing genes and seeing what happens to the cell, and then we try to work out how the biology works based on that. And I think what we need to do now, as in evolutionary cell biology, is to close the loop here. And there's one thing that's very interesting, and I don't think many people at this meeting are doing ecology, but like we heard from Ned, we know a lot about the phenotypes in the lab. We don't know much how these phenotypes can affect fitness, because this all depends on the ecology. So it might be interesting eventually to consider the ecological part of it. And I think the most interesting things that are coming, thanks to the development of genomics and high-throughput methods, is that we can start thinking about mutations that are other mutations than just gene deletion. We can ask, how can you construct cellular phenotypes from mutations and from different types of mutations? And I think this is one interesting avenue, because we can start asking, what kind of structures or features can you make in networks from all the available mutations for that specific organism that you study? So this is how I see it, and we try to do some of that. We don't do all of it, because we don't have the skills to do all of it, but I'll talk about some of that this morning. So this is Guillaume Dis. Guillaume is the first PhD, one of the two first PhD students I had in my lab. We just finished last year, so I've been through a round of one cohort of PhD students. And when Guillaume came to my lab, he was interested in this very general question, why are some gene deletions really bad and other not that bad? And the motivation from that is, you know, is a long, the question, that type of question has been around for a long time. And I would say it became possible to study that question when we started to be able to delete many, many genes in a given organism. And this organism that was Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and when people started deleting genes in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, so you could delete every gene one by one and see what the effect of these deletions were, they realized that there's about only 20% of genes that are essential. And this number is about the same that you find in other distantly related yeast species like Schizosaccharomyces pombe. It's always around 20%. So there's 80% of genes that you can remove, and the cell will still grow in happy conditions in the lab. And one of these mechanisms, one of the obvious reasons why this happens, is that many genes are present in duplicates. they are what you can call them duplicates of paralogs. I'm going to talk about paralogs. It means that they have recently in their history a common origin. So the gene duplicated, and now in this particular lineage, you have two copies that diverge by different amount of time. And so if you look at the, if you classify all the gene deletions from these in these experiments, you can classify them as having a weak effect on fitness, or as being lethal, which means a very bad effect, very strong effect on fitness. Then you see that the genes that are in single copy in the genome tend to have a very strong effect on fitness. They tend to be lethal, and genes that have duplicates tend to have a weak effect. So this is one of the reasons why many genes are not essential. There's a redundant copy in the genome. And this is, I mean, this is genetics, right? It just tells us that this is happening. It doesn't tell us why mechanistically having two copies of a gene, which presumably do different things in the cell, can actually compensate for each other's loss. And this is definitely important beyond yeast. So beyond Saccharomyces cerevisiae, because if you look at eukaryote genomes in general, you know, you find, depending on, of course, the lineages and the time since there has been gene duplication or whole genome duplication, you'll find that about 30 or 65% of genes in the typical eukaryotic genome has a duplicate in the genome. Yes? If they, well, that's one thing I'm gonna, so the duplicates, they are not, when we say duplicates, it's not two copies, exact copies of the same gene. You can see that they have a recent common ancestor, but the sequences have diverged, and their function might have diverged enough that there might be a new function that evolved in one of the copy, and this function might be essential in a particular set of conditions. Yeah, that's exactly that. You can imagine that, I'm going to talk about that, but right after duplication, they are fully redundant. And as you go along, there are many genes that might be duplicates of each other, and they are so different that we can't actually tell that they are duplicates, and those might be essential genes now. Yeah, it's a question of time frame. Eventually, they might become completely different, and you won't even be able to say that they are duplicates. Yes? Yeah. It's very interesting. I don't know. People haven't done these studies systematically in these organisms, but presumably you see the same type of effects. Yeah.
What's your risk? You can deal with being tetraploid.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the yeast strains that I know that are tetraploids are hybrids between species. Somehow, if you cross different species of yeast, the most stable state is tetraploid. You just undo duplicate each of the genomes, and then you end up having a tetraploid organism. It's very difficult to do. So you can construct yeast strains so that they have four sets of chromosomes, so they are tetraploids, but this is very unstable. And if you grow them long enough, they end up being diploid. Same thing, if even being haploid is unstable. If you grow a haploid strain long enough, it will end up being diploid. It's kind of so it's very difficult to work with something more, with more copies of genes. It's based on sequence.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, every time somebody identify homologs, it's basically based on sequence. The one layer of information you can add to that if a whole chromosome was duplicated or a whole genome, you can also look at their position along the genome, and you say, well, this gene is between these two other genes, so this gene, you know, should be homolog because it's also flanked by these two other genes. But this is only helping what is based on sequence homology. Yes.
That there was a complete genome duplication in cervical.
Yeah. So I will talk about that. So there's 500 pairs of genes in Saccharomyces cerevisiae that come from the old genome duplication, which predates the formation of the genus Saccharomyces. I will talk about that a little bit. Yes. The segment, yeah.
There's sort of an exponential decay, basically.
Yeah, okay.
It sort of follows an exponential function, the length of the duplicated fragment. So, I mean, the short ones don't give you much.
Yeah, okay. So, what we started doing with Guillaume was to look in the literature and try to see which kind of mechanisms people have identified that could explain why two genes that look like if they're doing something different, but when you remove one of them, the other might compensate for this loss. And one of the obvious cases is as Matt mentioned, is gene dosage. You can imagine having duplicates, if you could consider them as being alleles of the same gene. And for most of genes, when you remove one allele, you don't see any phenotype because you have one allele left. So it's just a question of quantity. So if you have two paralogs in a wild-type strain, and then they have some overlap function that they share, and then you have some quantity of that function, and if the relationship between the phenotype or fitness and that function looks like this. If you're here on the plateau, you have an excess, if you will, of function in normal cell. And then if you remove one copy, you're moving there. So you move one paralog, you don't see much of an effect. And so that might be, that's what we call passive compensation. There's just, you just have more, too much of one function for what you need. And there's no serious effect when you remove one of the two paralogs. And then there are more molecular mechanisms that people have reported. And so we reviewed the literature, and people have seen these effects in different contexts. One of them is change in expression. So when you, it's here you have the two duplicates, as we were talking about. And in a certain context, you could have one of the two only that's expressed. And somehow the expression of this one represses the expression of the other. And it doesn't need to be a molecular repression, direct repression. It can be a feedback loop through the metabolism that represses this gene. And then when you remove this first paralog, then you have the expression of the second paralog. There are only a few cases of paralogs that could compensate each other's loss that behave like that. And there's some controversy around that because it, I can talk about that later. And then you can have changes in protein interactions. So you have, in normal cells, you have your paralog here, the blue interacts with an interaction partner, and the red is excluded from this interaction. But when you remove the blue, then maybe you see these interactions. So this red has kept the ability to interact with the gray protein, maybe with a lesser affinity. But then when you remove the blue, you see this happening. There was no, before we started, there was not much known about this mechanism in the literature. The other mechanism that people have identified, and there's some examples of that in yeast, is changes in localization. So you have some subunits of the vacuole or ATPase, for instance, for which you find two paralogs, one that is in the vacuole or the lysosome, and the other is in the Golgi, and when you delete the one that is in the lysosome, now you see the Golgi ones that gets localized in the lysosome. The reason why I'm saying, so I'm talking about that now, and I want to stress that I'm not saying that the paralogs are maintained because they can do that. This is just a consequence of having two genes that have a common ancestor, and they keep some of their shared functions for some time, which makes them capable of compensating for each other's loss. So I'm not saying that selection is favoring that, although there might be specific contexts where this could be the case. So Guillaume was interested in this part here. And so we turned to protein interaction networks. And we used the Saccharomyces cerevisiae protein interaction network. And when I was a postdoc, I worked with Steve Michnik at the University of Montreal and work on this particular network. I'm going to tell you specific aspects of it before. So you all know about that. So the white circles are proteins, and they're connected by these edges the red edges when they interact with each other. And we can see modules in these networks, like Kim was talking about, by clustering these modules. And then you can see groups of proteins that share molecular functions clustered together, or protein complexes that cluster together. Yes? Yeah. Well, this is based on, this is not like an absolute cutoff. This is based on enrichment. You take this cluster here, and there's more enrichment for intracellular trafficking. This might be more like the Golgi, and this would be a general thing. So this could be, you could have a subset of one in the other, and then you see different enrichments. Yeah. Well, the reason they're not merged is because statistically they form different clusters. And the terms that describe this cluster are those terms. Yeah. It means that in the cell they hang out, these guys spend more time together than with these guys. You know, we can look at the details to see what actually the functions are, but this is just a general thing. All right, so just to reiterate what I said before when I was answering one question, so this is the model of how people see the evolution of protein interaction networks by gene duplication. And I'm making different categories here, but you can mix them, obviously. So this would be an initial network. This is quite simple, and people have worked on that, including Mike, for different functions for a long time ago. This would be our initial network with the protein we're interested in, A, and then there's a duplication of A, and you know, right after duplication, if you don't change the level of expression of the new duplicate, they are completely redundant. So there's no reason why they would have different protein interactions. And then there's, you know, generally three things that can occur. First, you can lose the new duplicate and you go back to the ancestral state. And this is probably what happens most of the time. So Mike has shown in mutation accumulation experiments that the rate of gene duplication is very high. We don't see that many gene duplications in natural populations. We see them, but we don't see lots of them. It's because many of them appear and many of them disappear. So we are in a state where we can go back very often to this state. Or you can have the two paradox that lose interactions, and they become specialized on a specific subset of interactions. And there's a specific term for that, subfunctionalization. And then maybe you cannot lose one or the other now because they have completely different functions. And one thing, so people have called that also embellishment, because you get more complexity here. You're creating more complexity in the network, but actually there's nothing new that was gained. So it goes back to what Mike was saying yesterday. You basically have the same functionality that what you had here. And then you can create, you know, new functions, new interactions can appear. Like this paradox here maybe was gained new interactions and now is doing something different. And you can have, you know, mixes of these two. So what Guillaume wanted to test in the protein interaction network was the following. So maybe we're in a state like this now. We have the two paradox. They seem to have different interaction partners, but maybe they gain the ability to interact. They just exclude each other through competition, for instance. And when you remove, we can test that by removing this second paradox and see if this paradox here would gain these interactions. And this is kind of easy to think about. It's more complicated to do because it means that you need to study protein interactions and you need at the same time to delete genes in the genome. So this is what we set out to do. So you can imagine you choose one node in this network and you want to see if this interaction between B and C depends on a third protein, then you need to delete it and measure this interaction again. And this is what we developed to do, a system we developed to do experimentally. I'm going to tell you some details about the experiments because some of you guys are doing experiments here at the school. So maybe you're going to be interested into that. So the way we measure protein interactions, and we have to do that in living cells, is using a technique that's called protein fragment complementation assay. So we have our two proteins of interest here, and we fuse these proteins with fragments of a reporter protein. In this case, this is one enzyme that that Kim talked about. This is the HFR enzyme that we use. And if there's an interaction, physical interaction, or a close proximity between our two proteins of interest, this enzyme will be reconstituted and will be functioning. So the way we use this assay is that we transform that into a selection assay, where the DHFR we use is engineered to be insensitive to a drug called methotrexate. So if we put methotrexate in the growth medium, it's going to inhibit the function of the endogenous yeast DHFR. But this DHFR here will keep functioning. So if there's an interaction in the cell, we will see an cell growth. And if there's no interaction, the cells would be eliminated. They won't grow. Yes?
Do you expect this will have a higher fraction of false positives?
It's a good question. I think false negatives in these technologies are a bigger problem. Yeah. There's one reason, and I will tell you on the next slide. The C termini, so we tag the proteins at the C termini, they need to be near each other in order to see the interaction. Already there, that's something. So if you could do all the pairwise comparison C and N and N and C, then you would see a lot more. And then there's also the issue of maybe some of the proteins don't get localized properly and some, you know, all sorts of things, yeah. Yes? We see interactions in nuclear proteins as well. I would say the big difference between this assay and other assays is that this works for membrane proteins, and whereas many other assays don't. And this is a nightmare as well, because in membrane proteins, you have a local effective concentration that's really high, so you get things become more complex to do experimentally. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, we get a range of, even at a given concentration of methotrexate, we get a range of interactions. So what you get something that looks like I will show you later, a bimodal distribution, where you have background growth and noise, and then when there's growth, there's actually a good relationship or correlation between the growth of the cells and the amount of complex that's being formed. So we use that as a quantitative measurement of protein complex formation. We don't know exactly what's the relationship between the two. We just know it's correlated. So if you look at highly abundant proteins, you get, you know, bigger colonies. Lowly abundant proteins, you get smaller colonies. And it's kind of a linear relationship between the log of the abundance of the proteins and the signal, which is useful for what I'm going to tell you about. OK? So you know now that yeast comes into Saccharomyces cerevisiae, it comes into two flavors, MAT A and MAT alpha. They are different sexes, and they are haploid. So we can construct the strains in haploid backgrounds, and then we can cross them if we want to test for an interaction. So we introduce the DHFR fragments in the genome. So we have something like 4,500 MAT A strains with this the first fragment, and the same number with the second fragment. And if we want to test for pairwise interactions, what we do is that we cross them together. We create a diploid that expresses these fragments. So what's interesting about this assay is that it gives us a kind of semi-quantitative assay. We can measure growth of the colonies, and we can see changes in interactions. And when I was with Steve Michnik, we constructed all collection of yeast, so we have almost every gene tagged in one or the other construction when it was possible to do. And one of the interesting aspects of this also, and we're trying to exploit this in projects that I'm not going to talk about, is that so this is our two proteins here, and we're using linkers that are repeat of 10 amino acid glycines and serines, which means that when we see an interaction between proteins, they have to be somewhere in close proximity in the protein complex. So if you look at when we studied the RNA polymerase, for instance, we could look at all pairwise protein interactions within the complex, and presumably everything interacts with each other either directly or indirectly. But with this method, what you see is that you see a strong enrichment for interactions that are that for between proteins that have their C-termini within a given distance. We use a cutoff that corresponds to the length of the two linkers in this case. It's not perfect, but it means that when we see an interaction protein, it means that the proteins are near each other. And this is going to be the last experimental design slide, because this is, I think this is kind of cool and showing how yeast is useful for these types of experiments. So now we have a method to study protein interactions, and we wanted to be able to study these interactions in many different genetic backgrounds. So the way we did that is that we use markers that people have developed in yeast that are used to selectable markers that allow us to select the mating type that you want and the ploidy level that you want, which allows you basically on place to kill diploid cells and to select only the MAT A or the MAT alpha. So it means that all the experiments, instead of going in and constructing all the strains we needed by gene deletions, we could just do that genetically by breeding yeast and plating them on different conditions. So these markers are in this strain here that's called SGA. This is from Charlie Boone's lab in Toronto. They call that the synthetic genetic array technology. And we can introduce these markers in the yeast deletion collection. The yeast deletion collection is a set of 5,000 strains that have each one gene deleted. So these are the colors here. So we have now the two yeast deletion collections, each having these markers. And now we can take these deletion collections, cross them with the PCA collections, which are shown by the gray, the circles here. So we can make these crosses, and then you do some genetics, and then you get a yeast PCA collection that contains gene deletions. So now you can take, you have one, what we call a bait, one protein tag with one fragment, another protein tag with the other fragment. They also have different deletions, and then you can cross them together. So now you're measuring one protein interaction in one deletion background. So if you do the math, that's a huge space now that you can cover. There's no way we can cover it all, because you have millions of pairwise interactions possible in thousands of genetic backgrounds. So that makes things very difficult to do comprehensively. We do all experiments on plates like this. Maybe you have seen that before. Those plates are this size, and you can replicate from one plate to another using what we call pin tools, which are needles coming down and just poking one of the colony, and then you transfer that to another plate. And you can do all the crosses and the genetics using that. And you can see this is not a random plate. Things that have been replicated on the array. You can see these colonies here are show protein-protein interactions, and then you have the background growth in the middle. Okay, now some biology. So we couldn't do all of the protein interactions. So what we decided to do to see if the assay was working and to learn something about evolution was to start with two protein complexes that we knew we could study with this technology and do the experiment that I mentioned before. So we measure pairwise interactions within these complexes in all of the deletion backgrounds of the proteins in this complex. So we chose two complexes that are quite different, but for practical reasons. One of the complexes is the retromer complex. So the retromer complex is involved in the retrograde transport of proteins from the endosome to the Golgi. And this complex is dispensable. You can remove all of the subunits of the complex, and in standard conditions, yeast are fine. So that's a good test model where we can remove everything in the complex and the cells are okay. And it doesn't contain any paralogs. And then the other system we studied is the nuclear pore complex, which is a complex that you find in the nuclear envelope and that regulates the transport of macromolecules from the cytoplasm to the inner parts of the nucleus. And this is a huge complex that's composed of, depending on the species, between 25 and 50 different proteins, but there's about 500 copies of proteins in there. So many protein is there in several copies. This is, of course, it is not surprisingly essential, but many subunits of the complex are not essential. The complex itself is essential. You cannot live without it. And as I will show you, this complex evolved by a lot. The complexity of this complex comes largely from gene duplication. So that's a good model for us. So this is the inner part of the nuclear pore complex. This is the cylinder that you find in the middle. And there's other things that connect the nuclear pore complex with the nuclear envelope. And you, what you see if this, in this cylinder is a repetition of different columns of protein complexes, the red and the blue here. And if you, so this is the work by Michael Roth. This is not from my lab. And this is a model that they produced based on a lot of different experimental methods. And then they modeled the nuclear pore complex and they optimized the structure based on the signal that they had in these experiments. And if you look at these different columns here, you see that they are composed of largely homologous proteins. So in some cases, you find the same proteins repeated in the subunits, like NAP82 is there in the red and the blue column, and NIC96 and NSP1. But the other proteins here are homologous to each other, so they are paralogs. This NUP170 and NUP150, for instance, they are paralogs from what we mentioned before, the whole genome duplication. So I put these three here to remind you of what it was. So we have the yeast phylogeny here, we have Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and somewhere in its history there was whole genome duplication, and many of the paralogs were maintained. And some of the paralogs from this whole genome duplication are right here in the nuclear pore complex. These three pairs of paralogs, for instance, are segregating differently in these different columns. And if you look within each of these columns, what you see, so this is a matrix of the contacts among the proteins, you see very similar contact matrix. So these things are very, very similar structurally. But some of them contains one paralog and some of them contains the other paralog. This is what the model says. So what do these two complexes look genetically if you study them in terms of genetic interactions, which is not based on protein-protein interactions? So this is what the data looks like. I just want to remind you, we've talked about a lot about genetic interactions in this meeting so far. And the type of interaction I'm going to talk about here is very similar to what people have talked about when they talked about epistasis. So a group of Charlie Boone have studied genetic interactions in among almost all of the yeast genes. So we can actually look in these protein complexes how it behaves. And the way to look at genetic interactions is the following. So we have we compare the fitness of the wild type strain to the fitness of the single deletion. So here is the fitness of the strain when you delete gene A and gene B alone. And then if you want to see if there's a genetic interaction between these two genes, then you compare the double mutant with the single mutant. So normally, if the two deletions would behave additively, you would expect this fitness here. If you have a negative genetic interaction, like synthetic lethal, for instance, you would get a much lower growth rate than you expect based on additivity. And then if you could also have something opposite, like what you have here, where people call buffering or positive genetic interactions. Basically, the growth rate of the double mutant is actually much better than what you would expect from the single deletions. And what this suggests in these, when people analyze this type of data, they try to infer the structure of protein complexes or pathways based on these fitness profiles. So when you have these positive genetic interactions, they say they infer that you have some linear relationship like this in a pathway where you have A and B that are in a given pathway. And if you remove A, you have a fitness defect. If you remove B alone, you have a fitness defect. But when you remove the two, you don't get something worse than removing one or the other. You already killed the pathway. That's why you get a positive interaction, because the sum of the two is actually much better than what you expect. And the type of pathway that in which they expect to see these negative genetic interactions would be where you have some redundancies, independent pathways that provide the same phenotype. In this case, when you remove A, for instance, you don't see anything because there's B contributing to the phenotype. If you remove B alone, you don't see anything because A contributes to the phenotype. And then if you remove both of them, then you don't have any phenotype anymore. Now you have a lethal genetic interaction. Yes? Yeah.
Are they interacting with the ones that haven't been the duplication?
It's a good question. Some of them are interacting, but a lot of them are in different subcomplexes. Eventually, you could say they are all interacting, but you mean by physical, direct physical interaction? Yeah, some of them are very nearby, and some have a close contact, yeah. So this is, we can look at the two complexes we study and looking at these interactions, and you will see that what we see here is going to fit with the type of perturbations we see in terms of protein interactions. So in the retromer complex, what we see is basically mostly positive genetic interactions. So when you remove two genes from this complex, it's not making things worse than when you remove one subunit or the other. Whereas in the nuclear pore complex, you see a lot of negative genetic interactions, and these are largely caused by the fact that you have paralogous genes in the complex. If you remove one of them, of the two paralogs, then the complex is presumably okay, but you remove two of them, then things get really bad. And if you look at all of the yeast protein complexes that are known, and you look at the correlation between the amount of negative genetic interactions they have and the amount of paralogs they have, you see a rather highly significant correlation. So this is a correlation between the amount of paralogs in a complex and the amount of negative genetic interactions like we see here in different complexes from different databases. And this is exactly what you see. Now we'll go back to our, so this would predict that when you remove one subunit of the retromer complex, you already damage the complex enough that even if you remove other subunits, it won't make any difference. Whereas here, you would have redundant parts that can maintain the structure when you remove one subunit.
Just to go back to
yes?
The ring,
well, that's what they say. Yeah, but I will come back to that at the end. What I think is possible is that these things they segregate. Maybe they don't stack together. That's what their model says. They make an average model of a nuclear pore in the cell.
This is sort of the ideal
yeah,
theory.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the conclusion of my talk. And eventually, no, that's fine. What it would be nice to do is maybe there's an ensemble of complexes where actually the paralogs segregate in different complexes, but they all mix up, and that's a totally different story than this one. But in order to do that, we need to study single complexes, and I mean that's something I would love to do, but I don't know how to do, not with the tools we have so far. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I think they are not paralogs in yeast. They have the same name. You cannot say based on sequences. In mammals, they are paralogs. Well, we can talk about that. But from what we've done, yeah. Yes, Andrew. Yeah.
And are therefore guaranteed to be essential, and genes that are parallel.
Yeah.
So every time you delete the essential genes, the thing's dead.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't show up in any of these
data sets. Yeah.
And in the paralogs, it's always going to be true that when you delete both copies, they're dead. Right? If you assume that.
My talk is not about this. I'm gonna. What the prediction would be. So the prediction is that I made before is that when you remove one paralog, the paralog that remains is now having these interactions that the other was having when it was there. Yeah. No, but I agree with you. It's kind of a tautology, right? If it's an essential complex, so yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so this is just to show you what we get when we do these interaction networks with the PCA. We don't get the nice structure I gave you before. We just get quantitative values for these interactions. So this is the matrix of interactions in the wild-type nuclear pore complex. For what we call the base, so this is one, the protein stack with one DHFR fragment, and here the protein stack with the other DHFR fragment, and then you have this, the PCA signal in the middle. So when these blue values are basically the background growth that we get on the plates, and the red here is the strong signal for which we infer interactions. So you can see what you can see from a map like this are modules of interactions where you, if you cluster the patterns of interactions based on this matrix, you get these groups of proteins interacting together, and this corresponds to the subcomplexes that you see, largely to the subcomplexes that you see within the complex. So this is the very coarse grain structure we can get with our interaction data. It doesn't look at all like the it's not as fine grained as the model we had before. And then you can already see from some of the paradox that they have different patterns of interactions in the complex. So you have NUP116 here and NUP100 that are paradox. You can see these interactions here are specific to NUP116, but they do share some interactions. And these guys, the signal is very weak, but we don't see them only for 116 and not the other. Okay, so this is another experimental result. So this is the type of data we get when we look at the retromer complex. So we look again. We measured all pairwise interactions within the complex and all deletion background of the complex. And here on the x-axis, you get the what we call the interaction score that is derived from the colony size in the wild type strains. And in the strains when there is a deletion that is introduced. Every data point here is an average of 12 different replicates. So we do that in a large number of replicates because we know that the yeast genetics introduce noise in the data. So what you see here are all these interactions that are very strong in the wild type and the mutant background. So we don't see any significant changes for those. But these interactions here would be interactions that are strong in the wild-type background, without now that are weak or disappear in the mutant background. So these are interactions that disappear when you introduce deletions, and these would be interactions that that would increase when you include deletions in the network. And then from there, we try to summarize the result by computing what we call a perturbation score, which is basically the difference between the score that we see in the delete and the score that we see in the wild type. So if it's positive, it means the interaction increases. If it's negative, it means that the interaction decreases. So if we put that back in a structural context, I'm going to show this map only for the retromer complex. We get this type of matrices. So this is every square in this matrix is the interaction network. So we have all the subunits of the retromer here on this axis and all of the subunits here. And all the entries within within this matrix is a pairwise interaction. So this is, again, the interaction score. When it's red, it's an interaction. And when it's blue, it's a lack of interaction. And I told you before I was going to mention the bimodal distribution. You can see the bimodal distribution here. So this is one peak and the other peak, and we can differentiate statistically these two distributions. That's what these numbers here are showing. This is the probability that this, if you have these values, you are in the distribution of the positive interactions. So this matrix is now a multi-dimensional matrix where you have the network that we measure among the subunits of the retromer complex in all of the possible genotypes of the complex. So you have here on this axis the genotype of one strain in one mating type and the genotype of one of the other strain in the other mating type. So on the diagonal, what you see are homozygous deletion strains. And then you can see in the, when you have some subunits that are homozygous, like VPS29 and 35, you have most of the interactions that disappear. The complex disassembled completely, except for one subunit. So Joel, you were mentioning these two subunits here, this Cmixin. Yeah. You think they are paralogs? That's what we can talk about that. But yeah. So these, if you cluster If you look at the patterns of deletions, the subunits, the effects that you see when you delete subunits of a given complex are more similar than subunits of the different complexes. So we can kind of see the pattern of the structure of the complex where you have one, the core complex here, and this the synexin subcomplex.
What is
HO
first?
Oh, yeah, sorry. HO is the control wild type background. It's the deletion of a marked gene in the genome, so it doesn't affect any of the interactions. It's the endonuclease that's knocked out in all of this, the yeast strains. All right, now we wanted, yes?
Oh, wait.
What?
I was curious for the NPC or whether it's possible that we can have partial assemblies.
Yeah, that's the, I think in the nuclear pore complex, I haven't seen any data on that. In the retromer, there is. So there are models that say that the core complex assembles independently from the synexin subcomplex, and then so we have subassemblies, and then you have an assembly of the complex.
Of the.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could imagine, you know, two things on their own interacting, or in the case of the NPC, maybe there being sub-assemblies of interactions,
yeah.
And those still giving you positive
growth. Yeah. I don't know if that's the case. I don't think that people know if the nuclear pore complex there is sub-assemblies, and then presumably there is, because assembling such a big complex, you know, all at once is probably impossible. Yeah, but that's something we should do. Look at whether these interactions occur before the assembly of the nuclear pore complex or just right in place. Yeah. All right. Now I come to the data that tells us if the idea that Guillaume had is correct. So this is So this is the distribution of perturbation score that we see in the nuclear pore complex and the retromer. And this is summarizing the effect of deleting a gene on the interaction networks. So this is in black, we see the distribution that we see in the nuclear pore complex. And this is related to what Andrew was saying, is that you cannot destroy the complex. We know it's essential, so you cannot destroy it. That's kind of a obvious thing. And so the perturbations you see some losses of interactions that are rather mild, and some gains of interactions. And actually, if you look carefully, there's an excess of gains of interactions in the nuclear pore complex. There's a little shoulder here. In the retromer complex, we see a different behavior. We see a bimodal distribution of effects on the interactions. So we see we see some gains of interactions, but in most cases, we see losses of interactions. So the complex, as I showed on the map before, tends to disassemble when you remove some of the subunits. And this is, again, this is not that surprising that it can happen. I mean, it can happen because it's a non-essential complex. Of course, it could also be more robust even if it's a non-essential complex. In the case of the nuclear pore, we could not expect something different because we know it has to be there. Now we want to test the perturbation that happens when we delete paralogs of a gene. So remember the model that Guillaume had in mind was the following, was that you have the two paralogs here that have different interactions. And when you remove one of the paralogs, then you see these interactions that are gained. And this is what this distributions are showing. So we have here, we're considering all the genes in the nuclear pore complex that have paralogs. And then we can ask what happens to the interactions for that protein when we remove any other gene or when we remove paralogs of that gene. So this is what the two distributions are showing. So in blue are the response of the interactions between one protein and other proteins when we remove any other protein that is not its paralog. So we take one protein and we remove other proteins, and we see how its interactions are changing when the protein that we're removing is not its paralog. Okay? And in red, we look at the same value, but when the protein that we remove is the paralog of the protein we're examining. And what we see is that we see a distribution centered around zero for the first case. And what we see is an excess of gains of interactions when we remove the paralog of the protein we're interested in. And I don't have the data here, but most of the changes that we see are with the interaction partners of the paralogs that was there before. So this is the data. I mean, we don't have the structural data. The only data I can show you that we can get from that is quantitative data. But it supports this model here, where when you delete one paralog, you see these gains of interactions. And you see that more often than when you delete a gene that is not the paralog of that particular gene here. So it seems that, at least in the nuclear pore complex, where we see a lot of paralogs, we see this, these effects that Guillaume expected. Yes?
So the simplest interpretation of that result would be that you have two paralogs. One has a greater affinity for a particular...
That's what we're testing, yeah.
...partner, so it freezes out the other one, and when you remove them. So that's your interpretation.
That's my interpretation now, yeah. Cool. So what we've done now, this is... What we've done, I will come to that, and we're doing that for a large number of paralogs and not that are not necessarily in protein complexes. And the data looks exactly like what you say. Yeah. So it means that when we, in wild type cells, when we think that two paralogs have different functions, they're basically one is excluding the other, and when you move the other, then you still have this leftover function. Yes? Yeah, we did that. I don't have that, but in the paper, we do all the Western blots, and we. In the nuclear pore complex, we don't see increases in abundance. So it seems at least not that we can detect with Western blood. So if it's 5% or 10%, maybe we can't measure that. Yes?
So it seems like some of the results could be explainable by the fact that the retinal is only six components and then the nuclear pore is 40 or 50.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you take away one piece of the six protein
components,
it's going to have a huge effect.
I'm skipping a lot of the details. Even in the nuclear pore complex, when you take the whole complex, and we know that there's a lot of deletions that have strong effects, and those tend to be at the core of the complex, in the middle, and if you delete things that are in the periphery, you don't see much of an effect. So there's clearly some of that. If you're in a small complex, there's no core, everything is in the periphery. Again, this is kind of the first shot at a problem like this. Ideally, we would like to have the structure I showed you in each of those cases, and then we could actually interpret that in terms of structural biology. Yes?
Is it sort of like competitive binding?
That's my interpretation. So now in the lab, we're doing these experiments to test this hypothesis. So we're playing around with the abundance of the two proteins and see if you increase the expression of the paralog that's usually not showing interaction, now do you decrease the interaction? So we're doing the reciprocal experiment. Yeah.
Can you then sort of change the dynamics if you remove one of them? Because now, like, the one guy has to do, like, the job of three while before they were splitting the.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, does the complex assemble, or would you assume that the complex assembles like slower?
Well, that's a good question. We can't do that in this particular case, but that would be. Presumably, there's some effect. Yeah. Yes.
This might be just my misunderstanding of what it is you're trying to explain to us. But do you then see that all of these interactions are two-directional? So if you remove one of the paralogs, you see compensation, and so too with the other side.
No, it's not always bidirectional. It's not always reciprocal. No, we see that sometimes in one direction and not the other. Yeah. Yeah.
The factor all depends on relative affinity.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. So the conclusion from that is that you don't need to invoke any. So if you look at in the literature, they try to find cases like very complex mechanisms for which paralogs can compensate each other. Like one is more expressed, but now if they just look different because they outcompete each other, and then when you remove one, it's just a passive mechanism. It's just. In some sense, it's kind of boring in terms of explanation, but it fits more like the neutral expectation. Yes.
In addition to binding, difference in
Yeah.
Sometimes they control each other's expression as well. In such cases, what?
In this case, we don't see any change in expression. We did we measure the abundance of many of the subunits when we delete the paralog, and we didn't see any change in expression.
But would you expect that one of them could be the dominant than the other one?
Yeah. It could be a dominant if it's more expressed, for instance. And usually, if you look at, we've seen that in other papers, if you look at all of the paralogs, the one that, in all pairs of paralogs, systematically the one that is the most abundant has more protein interactions. So I think abundance is driving maybe more the system than the actual affinities. Because if it was driven by affinity, you wouldn't see this correlation with abundance. Yeah. Yes?
When you say the deletion of paralogs is not bidirectional,
yeah.
Is one of them the ancestral version, like before the whole genome duplication, and the other one is closer or something? Do we expect something like that?
Yeah, you think it would be related to the degree of divergence? We don't have enough data to say that here. Yeah, but with the other experiments we've done, yeah, maybe we can test that. Yes?
There are some aspects of your data that you can't interpret because you don't have the structural data.
Yeah, yeah.
But could you do the opposite? Could you say, based on our interactions, yeah. You make the following structural prediction?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're trying to do. Yeah. I mean, yeah. 9% of the work in this study was just getting the assays to work. But the most interesting part is to come. I agree with you. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's a good question. The thing is that when gene duplicates, there's no parent. These things are like twins, right? There's no really a parent, except it depends on how the duplication occurs. If it's sometimes you can say it's in the position of the ancestral copy, but when they started, they were equal, so there's not really the relationship between parents. But we often think this way. Because sometimes you can kind of infer that depending on the mode of duplication. If it's a retro position of an mRNA, then you can say this is the parent gene and this is the child. But in most cases, like for paralogs that occur through segmental duplication, they are born equal. So there's no parent and child. All right. So this is where we are anyway. You know, this is what the model we want to pursue in the future. So we think that when you have a simple, a complex with no paralog, maybe there's only one way to assemble. And when you delete subunits, then perturb the assembly. But when you have paralogs in the complex, there might be alternative configuration. So when you remove one of these two paralogs here, the orange or the red, you might have a different configuration of the complex. And then, of course, if you remove many of the paralogs, then maybe it can assemble. So the question that Mike was asking is that maybe these alternative configurations, they already exist in equilibrium in the cell, and they segregate in the cell. And what you see is that you just favor one configuration or the other when you delete one paralog. And this is something we would like to test. I don't know exactly how we're going to do that. Experimentally, but this is what I'm seeing here. This is exactly it. So when you look at the nuclear pore complex, that's a very interesting complex because we think that this is so conserved that it has a single function. But actually, if you look in mammals, different tissue types, they have different compositions of the nuclear pore complex. There are some subunits that change from one cell type to the other because the interior part of the nuclear pore complex is involved in regulating gene expression. There's some interaction with the chromatin that makes its function specific to some tissue types. So, and if you can change the composition from one tissue to the other, it means that within a given cell, you might have different configuration. And then when we finished this project, I talked to Mike Rout, who did the work on the structure, and to me, it's almost impossible to assemble a protein complex of 500 protein copies without doing any mistakes, right? There has to be some polymorphism within the cell, and maybe these paradoxes, they just segregate randomly between these different assemblies. I don't know. But eventually, what we'd like to do is to do single complex study where, so you can actually see if the two paradoxes are really in the same complex or they segregate in different complexes. And one thing we want to do regarding the evolution by gene duplication is to try to see what the ancestral autologue would do in this nuclear pore complex. Now we have these two paradoxes according to the model that segregate in different subparts of the complex. And if you can reconstitute the ancestral autologue of these two proteins, where is it going to be in the complex? Or can you even do that? So that's something we want to do.
Question.
Yes? Yeah.
Are these dynamic in the sense that if you do a Pratt experiment and look at the subunits, that they're constantly coming in and out of these assembled complexes?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, we haven't done that. I don't know if that's how the nuclear pore complex. If you see this dynamic in the nuclear pore complex, maybe that's the case. That would be interesting because then you could have. Then you could see the switch maybe and the stoichiometry in terms of the probability of switching between the two paradoxes. That would be a really cool experiment. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, the parts that I showed you are structural, like they maintain the structure, but they are like FG repeats in the middle that make the basket, that make the filter. This is highly dynamic. This is all disordered proteins, and these things float around, and those might be exchanging rapidly. Yeah. So, yeah, the stuff I'm showing is really the core of the complex that maintains the structure. Yeah.
If you've done deletions of all of the proteins, you might actually have the information.
Yeah. Many of those are essential because they're in the middle, and if they're not essential, they really screw up those are the worst those have the worst effect on the structure. The ones that are in the contact with the membrane.
Right.
Yeah.
You would have the information about which ones those are interacting with, right?
Yeah, we have some information on that. Yeah, yeah. And those look like membrane binding. You know, they look like code, vesicle codes or something like that. Those are that's the ones you're talking about. Yeah.
No, that ones are vesicle codes, not the clonal ones. The ones that are actually physically making contact with the membranes.
Okay.
And what they're contacting with next.
Okay, but we can check at the I mean, there's a lot of limitation in our experiments. We see the interactions we see. We call that interactions, but it means the C-termini of the protein, they're close to each other. And if I were really picky about our assay, that's what I would say. And so